too many people that come in and promise, say, represent themselves as the cash buyer and put it under contract for no EMD or no due diligence and then back out of it. Or they go to the closing table, they don't know what's going on and things fall through, right? I mean, I think a lot of people get into wholesaling thinking that you just find a contract, you find a property, you get in a contract, you sell it, easy peasy. I mean, then you start doing it and you realize that there's a lot of tax issues, there's a lot of title issues, there's a lot of other things that you need to have a really good relationship with your attorney. You need to have really good communication skills with the seller, with your end buyer. And at the end of the day, like, your reputation is the most important thing to you. And sometimes you have to walk away from a couple thousand dollars because you can't buy your reputation with any amount of money, right? And I think people forget that and they get too focused on making a buck.
You're listening to RIA Radio, the nationally trusted name in real estate investing. We dig deep to discover investors' why in real estate. If you want to skip all the BS and get in investors' heads, you're in the right spot. Be one of the thousands to check out RIAradio.com. Lauren, one thing that you mentioned earlier was that you hired a new team member. And what exactly does your team look like today? And what are they doing for you?
Yeah, so to explain that, I have to first say what my businesses are. So I have more than one. So we have our primary rental business that actually also has the flipping in it. We also own a wholesaling business. And then I have a transactional lending business as well. So across all those teams, I have a business partner. I hired an executive virtual assistant a few months ago, which I'll talk more about that in a second. And then we recently started the wholesaling business like 17 days ago. And we have a VP of wholesale operations that I hired, and then two cold callers.
You mentioned wholesale. Is there any legal issues that you deal with wholesaling in your state?
No, not specifically. Earlier this year, the NC Commission on Real Estate did put out a letter that said that they can believe that assignment of contracts are a commission, that you should have a real estate license. But up to this point, they haven't gone after anybody. So it really has no teeth, even though there is a statute on the books. And so that was the precipice or the reason why I started the transactional lending business, because I see it going more that direction where assignment of contracts get pushed out and double closes become the norm. And I also see the benefits to the wholesaler for keeping their margins safe and things of that nature. But no, we don't have any other legal issues besides that one.
As far as I know, we're in Nebraska and we're the second state to have wholesaling laws make wholesaling legal. And they've added some, you know, gray areas in there recently, but pretty much if you are a real estate license and you're doing a transaction and you're not following their procedures that they just recently released, meaning that you have seller property disclosure statements, lead-based statements, and a form filled out that the seller is aware that the property is a wholesale for a profit, la-di-da-di-da. A agent can actually be fined up to $20,000 and suspended license up to 2 years for being involved in the transaction, period. And my business model for 5 to 7 years was working with every wholesaler in the city and then representing the buyer, getting the assigned contract, and then my client paying my commissions. Because I always had the mentality is I don't get two shits what the wholesaler made as long as the numbers work out for everybody and everybody's happy in the end. And obviously if somebody's selling a property to a wholesaler, they're happy with it, but it's the bad wholesalers in the end that don't have the ability to sell that deal, or they overpromised and underdelivered. But
yeah, and I think that's what's going to cause the change in the market or in the legislation is too many people that come in and represent themselves as the cash buyer and put it under contract for no EMD or no due diligence and then back out of it. Or they go to the closing table, they don't know what's going on and things fall through, right? I mean, I think a lot of people get into wholesaling thinking that you just find a contract, you find a property, you get in a contract, you sell it, easy peasy. I mean, then you start doing it and you realize that there's a lot of tax issues, there's a lot of title issues, there's a lot of other things that you need to have a really good relationship with your attorney. You need to have really good communication skills with the seller, with your end buyer. And at the end of the day, like, your reputation is the most important thing to you. And sometimes you have to walk away from a couple thousand dollars because you can't buy your reputation with any amount of money. Right. And I think people forget that and they get too focused on making a buck.
Yeah. Well said. Now, you mentioned double closing. This is something that I had in my notes to make sure and cover with you. Talk to us about that business. So that's what is your, you have a double closing company that they basically handle transactional deals with wholesalers who are getting a property under contract with a seller. They're turning around and they're actually closing on it, but they're selling it the same day typically to someone else. Can you tell us what is a double closing? How does that work other than what I just fumbled through? And why did you decide to become a lender on those type of deals?
Yeah. So double closing, just like what you said, it's essentially within 24 to 48 hours, the wholesaler is the buyer and they're purchasing the property from the seller, and that is actually getting recorded. And then within that day or the next day, then the wholesaler becomes the seller and sells it to the end buyer. And what this does is create two separate recordings. And unlike an assignment of contract where everyone's privy to what the purchase price was, what the end price was, what the assignment fee is, like, there's a little bit more anonymity about who the seller is, what they're buying it for, who the end buyer is, what they're buying it for. So it protects the wholesaler in a lot of ways, in that the end buyer is not seeing what they purchased it for, and the seller is not seeing what they're, because they could have been happy with making $60,000, and then all of a sudden they see the wholesaler made, you know, $10,000 on top of that. Some of that goes into communication. But when that letter came out earlier this year in North Carolina that said that, you know, we see this as a commission, and that, you know, I basically saw that in a couple of years, I see more and more of these happening, more and more of these double closes happening. And when they happen, the wholesaler is responsible for funding 100% of the purchase price and closing costs between them and the seller. Now, a lot of wholesalers don't want to sit on $50,000, $70,000, $80,000, $150,000 in order to just fund these. And so what my company does is says, great, you've got a contract, you've got an end buyer. I will come in and I will fund 100% of that purchase price between you and the seller and all of the closing costs. So you're $0 out of pocket. I won't charge you anything until the deal closes. So I only make money if you make money, right? And on top of that, I already have a relationship with a lot of these attorneys. I know how this process works. And so in a lot of cases, I end up being more of a transaction coordinator for them so that they can go out and find more deals and spend their money on marketing instead of on these. And then when the BC or the second close happens, then I get my principal back from the attorney as well as my fee, which I just charge a flat 1%. And that comes back to me. And then the wholesaler gets their fee and everybody's happy, right? And so it's a very straightforward business model. It's a lending company, but it really is more of a service industry or service business where I'm taking the inputs from the wholesaler and I'm communicating regularly with them. I'm walking them through what needs to happen with the closing attorney. I'm following up with the closing attorney, making sure the HUDs are correct, and then wiring funds and receiving funds back.
Now, the thing I like about that business model is you're basically churning the same money and making a little bit more each time. So you can like exponentially grow your stack of cash, mm-hmm. assuming you reinvested in there. But have you had any deals that have not closed on the back end, or something that's happened that's been weird during the transaction where you didn't get made whole right away and there was a little bit of panic or drama?
No, we haven't. So in general, the weirdest ones are when you have two closing attorneys. So the nice ones are you have one closing attorney for the AB, which is the seller wholesaler side, and the BC, which is the seller or their wholesaler buyer side. And if it's all in one office, it's really straightforward. A lot of times what we'll have is two closing attorneys. And so in that case, we put a promissory note in place that they just have to sign, the wholesaler signs at the agreement of the signing of the AB. And we've had a couple times where it's stretched out a couple days, usually because of taxes or title issues that get hung up. But we really try to make it a process of okay, we know that the first time we wire money to an attorney's escrow account, it takes about 4 hours. If we've done business with that attorney in the past, it's only going to take about 2 hours for our money to leave our account and hit their account. And so we actively look for those closing attorneys to tell us when the end buyer's money hits the account or when all the paperwork has been signed, then we fund. But we also want to make sure that we're never the reason why a deal is delayed. And so we're kind of walking a fine line, and it becomes a lot of like the difference between sending money at 11 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon is whether the deal gets recorded today or not, or tomorrow, right? In a lot of cases. So it requires some watching.
I've been involved or seen some deals that have fallen through in that quick little process. Something goes down. So in the case that something goes astray and you are stuck with that property, will you just assume that property? Is that how it's written in there, or what would be the repercussions?
So the nice thing about owning rentals and flipping as well is that if that happens, then my rental and flipping business would pick it up at cost from the wholesaler. And we would take it on from there.
You wouldn't have to go through the whole entire foreclosure process?
Not if they sign it over to you.
Well,
I mean, the wholesaler is like, why would they want to stay in that deal? Like, right. They have no money. They have no, you know what I mean? Like,
but you have a hard money lending company. Yeah. And not everybody signs it over to you.
Well, what I was going to say is the very first deal that my hard money lending business, who I think we funded like 320 or 330 deals now in the last 2.5 years. The very first deal we did was with all of our own money. We all had collectively, all of the owners kicked in money into the business that totaled $1 million. Our very first wholesale deal was a double closing that was $1 million transaction.
Yeah.
And the B2C part of that equation, the end buyer didn't show up to sign paperwork. So it got delayed. Like, I want to say it was 24 hours, but it seems like it was 48, or at least in my head it was.
This is the David Bader one,
yes,
that we talked about on the podcast.
And it was, everybody was like, what the F is going on? You know, like, are we going to get paid? Like, it was, everybody was kind of freaking out a little bit because we were like, what's going to happen now? Like, obviously he's a good operator. David is. So mm-hmm. He's going to make it right no matter what. I wasn't really all that worried, but it's kind of nerve wracking when it's all your own money that is mm-hmm. like going out the door all in one fell swoop. But yeah, no, that's, I do love the double closing thing because like you can make a point off that. And we were super dumb when we first did ours, because I think we only charged like $2,000 or something on a million. Yeah, I know. I saw your cringe. We charged like $2,000 or something really dumb on that, where we should have charged a point. I mean, that's the norm, right?
I mean, at $1 million for 9 hours worth of work, I probably wouldn't have charged a point, but I would have charged more than $2,000.
Yeah, I know. It was dumb that we didn't offset the risk by increasing our price.
Those are additional fees for each day.
I'm going off of memory here. This is 3 years ago, but it was like we had written in there that we were going to have a default interest rate of like 24% if we weren't paid within 5 days of closing of that. So there was some teeth.
Yeah.
So if anybody's stuck in the A to B contract, they're going to be on the hook for paying a really stiff interest rate or just signing the contract over, like you said, or the property.
Yeah, ours is 15% after 48 hours of funding a couple weeks. And then it jumps to 25% or something significant.
Yeah. Then Rocco.
Sometimes things happen, right? And I'm a real estate investor. And so sometimes things happen. So at most of our average funding right now is like $86,000. So at 15% per day, it's like $30 to $50 a day. So like, it's not going to kill a wholesaler if that slips. We certainly don't want that to happen. But if it goes more than a week or two, then there's some significant teeth that go in.
Now, what I'm curious about, Lauren, is so you started that business. Is it all your own money? How much are you trying to grow that? Or it's just kind of like extra, transactional income that you make along the way when people need that type of loan? Is this a legit thing where you're like, I want to grow this shit and like branch out and all that?
I see a lot of opportunity there. So we're actively trying to grow. We're getting to the point where we're doing 3 to 5 deals a week now, and trying to get it to go further than that and looking at some additional products, not the stuff that you're doing, not long-term fix and flip or long-term, but more like gap funding. But we have investors involved that they take a percentage of the take for every one of our deals. And then, yeah, as we get bigger, we are looking into potentially starting some sort of fund that we could leverage the resources for that from the fund for this, as well as for our other businesses with flipping and rentals.
Well, offline, let's talk, because I can refer you to the SEC attorney that helped us set up our fund. So if that helps shortcut anything, or at least gives you a basis to start with, yeah, I'd be happy to introduce you guys.
You guys could just merge funds, and then
there we go,
and then trade funds back and forth.
Well, that's a thing. It's a fund to fund. Like, this is something we're actually looking into. We like snapshot in time. We have had over $12 million worth of loan requests in the month of September for liquid lending. And we can't fund all of them because our capital stack is loaned out. Yeah. And it's like, it happens, right? So like you get overweight with loan requests and you can't fund all of them. So then it's like, either you are able to source some additional capital that you can deploy into those projects, or you have to say no. And that sucks. And I hate saying no to people.
You should use your resources like this right here and create a fund network. And of other people like yourself, and try to have somebody in every state, and then you guys are all pooling your money together.
I don't know how this. So we were talking about this the other day, like actually yesterday, we had a like owner's call with our lending business, and we were talking about what would it look like, because you know we talk to other. There's only a small handful of hard money businesses in Omaha that are physically located in and around here, mm-hmm. and we know all of the owners, and we're all you know like frenemies, you know type of a relationship. So we all like, you know, we kind of have like an informal, hey, don't lend to this person type thing. Like, I'm not going to ever admit to this if I'm questioned by anyone. But it's a thing, like, you know, there's checks and balances here. But I've always been curious what I don't know how all this works. And I feel maybe a little ignorant in this. But how could, if you as a hard money lender or a double closing lender, you have some cash parked, right? And you're not getting loan requests that come in. Whereas me, I'm like overweight in a whole bunch of loan requests coming in that we don't have liquidity for. How could we work together to have that make sense for you to lend capital out and then us be able to have liquidity, make our customers happy so that we don't have to turn business away, but and not, you know, like we're not looking to make a huge amount of profit on that transaction, but like
but you don't want to say no.
Yeah, we don't want to say no. I want to get like, if you guys came and you're like, hey, we have this deal and we, you know, like it's a good deal, and we're like, I don't want to say no to you. I like, if we can find another way to fund it, we will, but I haven't navigated or looked into like how all the mechanics of that would work. So you're sharing the risk appropriately. You know, you're making enough margin to have everybody be happy with the deal. You know what I mean? So like, it's weird. The lending world is a different animal.
I think that's one of the really cool things just about real estate in general is that there's, you know, 15 ways to skin every cat, and you just have to like, you just keep learning to figure out how you can do something. Or it's never about rarely about can I or can't I, it's how can I, right? And so, you know, one of the ways for our business that we're trying to grow is we are specifically focused on transactional lending, right? We have no other products. And I've talked to a number of people that are, you know, fix and flip lenders that do some transactional lending on the side. And so what we're starting to do is reach out to those hard money lenders and be like, send us your transactional lending, right? You focus on growing your business where you're good at. We're really good at transactional lending. You send us that contact, and then we can create like an affiliate program where we have profit sharing. Every time that customer comes to me from then on forward, whether they ever come through you again for transactional lending, you're getting a piece of it. I'm focusing on my business and growing. You're growing in your business and getting a piece of that relationship.
Yeah, it's the fun thing about this whole deal is the further you get into this and the more facets of real estate you start like looking into, the more secrets you learn about like how the big players really do things. And like, you know, you can't do it at the level of like BlackRock or whatever, but I mean, there's the world of finance, there is so much stuff out there that we just like, the more that I've been involved in talking with brokers and private equity and like just the whole finance world, it's like, I don't even know what I don't know. Like, there are so many ways to make money in this business that you could be like, here, I have money. This is the way that I know how to do it. And then somebody comes along and they're like, Have you considered that you could like arbitrage this and like exponentially do blah, 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 or you just need to create a different bit? And you're like, what the hell did you just say to me? You know what I mean? You're like, whole world shifts. Like, I've had two or three of these moments just in the last year where I've been dealing with a lot more of private equity and just like alternative financing people that just have a viewpoint that you're like, this is, I don't even know what you're talking about. This is a different language. So it's, I don't know.
And when you go to these meetups like WealthCon, BPCon, you probably get, that probably happens a lot more, I'm assuming.
Yeah. And it's always with random conversations that you have with people too. Like, okay, so Lauren and I met at WealthCon in Las Vegas. And it was Ryan Pineda's conference that he put on. He puts it on every quarter, and it's a great event. There's usually about
It's every quarter.
Every quarter.
I didn't. Yeah.
Know. He's fact check me. He's the most consistent. Like, he does it. Yeah, he does it quarterly every single year. So like I don't know anybody else that does that.
1,200 attendees every quarter.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? But yeah, I met so Lauren and I met there.
We can do that.
Could we? We haven't even done one. Let's do one first. Okay. But yeah, that I remember. So you met Andrea, my business partner, yeah, with the Dashley Group. So we all went to lunch and hung out. Like, we spent some time together, Lauren and Andrea and I, and we were talking about your double closing business and like scaling up and hiring people. And like, we had a ton of really good conversations, but I was thinking, like, Andrew and I had just gotten there, and it was the very first day where they kicked off the event, and we were standing around Ryan Pineda's office where they were kind of like breaking out into three different groups, and they were showing like, here's where we do our podcast stuff. Here's where we do this and that. And like, here's how we put deals together and blah, blah, blah. And Andrew and I happened to be standing in the hallway. I think we were like looking for the bathroom or something. And there's, you know, like 200 people there in this building. And we happened to talk to this guy, and this guy was, God, I can't remember his name, but he was like a really, really, really big deal. Like,
you guys met in the bathroom?
No. Oh. If you listen, you would hear that I said we were waiting for the bathroom.
Oh, so this is the bathroom line.
Yeah. And so we happened to strike up a conversation with this guy, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, I do this and this and this. And I was like, what did you just say? And he's like, we own like a billion units, and like, we have this group and blah, blah, blah.
He has a billion units?
No, God, jeez, Mr. Literal. No, I'm saying he had like a ton of units, not a literal ton. He had a lot of units.
It was lots of you.
He had thousands and thousands of
like tens of thousands.
God, where are you going with this?
Because you know people have thousands. I just want to know what level this guy was at you're talking to.
Way more than anybody I've ever met in person.
Sweet. That's cool.
Yeah. And so anyway, my point being, he was there, and
more,
like, he was,
so wait. So more than Brandon Turner? Because you met him.
Lauren, help, please.
I just want to
waving the
just funny.
Yeah. Well, does Brandon Turner own all of them?
No,
I think not.
No, so
this guy owned the company that owns all of them.
Yeah, big deal.
All right, what are you doing, man?
I try to get more information.
All right, all right,
I want facts. So finish your story.
That's it. So
you got a guy that has thousands of units he owns himself.
Well, I was kind of on a roll before you started asking these. The roll still really weird questions.
The roll's still there, Owen. Just go there.
All right, so I'll keep rolling. Apparently, like Ted is on his uppers that he was on when he started the podcast. We were talking about like just a quick 10-minute conversation. The guy's like, oh, you know, we work with this private equity firm, and we work with this person, and we work with all these people, and we have this system, and we have this many employees. And we're just like, what the hell? Like, we just happened to run into this guy, and he was like totally approachable and just happened to be talking about it. That would have never happened if we wouldn't have been willing to have that conversation. So my point on that is, and we've talked about this a whole bunch, you go to conferences, talk to people. Like, that's the whole point. It's not to go there and listen to a speaker. And I hear this all the time from people who are like, well, I looked at the speakers and there just wasn't really much that I thought I could learn, or it didn't really apply to me. It's like, who cares? Mm-hmm. That's not why you go to that. If that, you know, like, it's networking. And like, you're on this podcast right now, Lauren, because we met in Las Vegas at a conference. Yep. So what could this lead to? We don't know. But now we're talking about, like, you do double closings, I do hard money. Like, I don't know. little something, something here. We could probably figure it out.
So we're going to have this one dude on the podcast that you talked to?
No, probably not, because he's going to listen to this and realize that you just just torpedoed this whole thing by asking really weird questions. Anyway, Lauren, back to you. So what's next for you guys? You guys have been doing a lot of like growing over the last 2 years. This is an insane trajectory that you're on. I would envision that you're, I know you're a systems and processes guy, but when you build the parachute on the way out of the plane, on the way down, it's like you got to make some really hard decisions on the way. So you scaled up really quickly with a lot of stuff. How are you? It sounds like you made some key hires.
Yep.
What do you guys foresee? Like, if we could fast forward and say we get together 1 year from now, what's changed in your business from now to then?
So I think the biggest change that we're going to see over the next few months is how we're purchasing or what we're purchasing. So when we started our business, we spent a good chunk of time the first 9 months basically just figuring out how to buy. Like, what's the process look like? How can we streamline that overall process to purchase? And then when we got into 2023, I realized that we need to focus on how we can build a business, right? And that's when the flipping came in. We needed to increase our cash conversion cycle. And that's why the wholesaling business is starting here right now. So my expectation is over the next year that we will go from being cash poor and equity rich to being significantly more liquid, with more closings that are happening much quicker, and then rentals being purchased more strategically based on cash holdings. I also think that the way we structure our lending to our lenders has a potential to change and move into a more formal process, similar to a fund, for a lot of different reasons, both beneficial to us and to the lenders. You know, right now I have 150 loans that I make payments on a monthly basis to my private money lenders. And we're doing that using basically Chase's bill pay service and ACH, reoccurring payments, and a CRM that I built out, right? So there's a lot of systems and automation that needs to happen. And our team is going to have to get bigger as I continue to try to move up and out of things and get out of the way as we grow.
Well said. Do you have a date picked out where you are no longer going to be gainfully employed? I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, we do have a date right now that is tentative on when some of the flips and some of that cash starts hitting. But yeah, my wife and I have had that discussion, and she's made some very clear requirements of this much cash needs to come in just flat, you know, and this is how much we need to have.
There was a PowerPoint presentation on this.
No, she gave it. So it was on a piece of paper because she's old school. But yeah, it was, we've had that discussion. I know what those stage gates are. And when I hit those, then that'll happen.
So speaking of Megan, one thing we haven't gotten into is your family life. You have four children. Yep. And if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but from 8 years to 10 months. So you have quite the household right now. How, with working a full-time job and having the portfolio that you created so quickly, like, how are you having that work-life, family-life balance? Like, what are you doing to make sure that you can be a present father for your children?
To say that it's easy would be a lie, right? It's extremely challenging because when you have
we don't want lying, bro.
It's extremely challenging because when you have four small children, like, they all need attention, and your businesses are basically, especially at this stage, they're basically small children. They need attention as well. And so I have not done as good of a job as I need to in the past of making sure everybody gets the time they need. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the time my wife takes more of the lack of time than my kids do. But I, you know, last couple months I've been more methodical about, like, my phone goes away at 7 PM. I don't sleep a ton, and I'm an early person, early morning riser. And so I usually get up around 4 to 5 and I start working, and work, you know, through the day, get as much as I can done before I have to go to my W-2, you know, work and do my W-2 as best as possibly can, while also kind of putting in a few things at lunch and whatever, and then work again in the evening until 7, and then 7, I try to shut it down as much as I possibly can. I think the challenge is, especially for, you know, people that have this much stuff going, and I don't want to call myself a high achiever, but, you know, someone that's achieving bigger things, is like, it's not as like, oh, I put my phone on and it's off, right? It's one thing to be present and another thing to actually be present in the moment, right? And so I have to constantly watch myself that when I'm with my family, I'm actually with my family, not thinking about the flip or like getting the permits to get the next thing, or if this property is worth a damn, or if the contractor or whatever the issue is, right? It's a challenging thing, and it's not something I have been as successful at as I have at buying properties. No, but I'm working on it.
One struggle I personally had just last night, I had to do some CE credit.
18 hours worth.
Yeah, 18 hours of CD credits that hit me up at 3 p.m. And to be able to keep our brokerage up and alive because I made a mistake and didn't finish a continuing ed course. And I coach my son's football team. I also coach my daughter's basketball team. And so I'm constantly going at night, but there was that one moment I had to tell the other coaches and tell my son, I'm like, hey, I'm sorry, I'm gonna come do the warm-ups here, but I have to go to the car and I have to study for this, and I had to separate myself, and it just killed me to do that, because these are moments that I'm trying to create with my family, but you know, this is something I couldn't step away from, and I already take time away to do all the meetups I go to at night, you know, because I try to limit myself to two work meetups a week, but I do that after we do dinner time. So there's a lot of structure that I put out there for when I'm going out and doing these work events, so I can have that time with the kids. But to tell my kid, and I feel like I was letting them down last night and say, hey man, I gotta sit in the car and do some studying.
Yeah.
You know, he understood, but you know, personally it was tough.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I limit myself to two meetups a month, so not a week, but two meetups a month. And I know that like my networking could grow much faster, and I could grow my business much faster and much stronger if like I didn't have the constraint of my family. But my kids are 8, 6, 3, and 10 months, and then you just extrapolate that out 10 years, right? And now you've got a 10-year-old, 13-year-old, 15-year-old, or 16-year-old, and 18-year-old. I got one basically out the door, and in 10 years I'll be in my mid-40s. With lots of work years left ahead. So I know that I'm sacrificing how fast the business could grow, but I'm not willing to make that sacrifice the sacrifice I have to make on the family side is bigger to me.
There's that meme that you see floating around that says the only ones that are going to remember that you worked late are your kids 20 years from now. Like that nobody gives a shit. So, but you can, it also depends on how
and your wife.
Well, that's also true. the way that you, I think that's smart though, what you're talking about. Like in, you know, Ted, I think anybody that knows, you put a ton of effort and you really care about your kids and your family and all that. Everybody knows that's a linchpin in your whole, you know, thing. But, you know, at the same time, I think if you position what you're doing in a way where your kids understand, or at least at a high level on why, then that goes a long way. You can say like, this kills me to do this, but this is something that could result in this for our family. And that's the only reason this is happening.
It was gonna be catastrophic.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, I think if you're like, I'm busy, and then you know what I mean? And like, it sucks doing that. Cause I've found myself short with my kids before when I'm stressed because there's urgent things that need to be handled. And sometimes it happens to happen at 7 o'clock at night or six. And I hate it when it does, but it does. I mean, it's just, you know, you just got to manage through it and do the best you can and tell your kids why.
On the way to that football game though, I have to share this. We had a fun conversation and you know, my son's 10 and he thinks he's going to be an NFL football player or some sort of professional sports. And so I go, hey, Carson, besides the professional sports, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he's like, a YouTuber. And he's like, I'm going to create content and I'm going to get people follow me. And I go, okay, well, if YouTube doesn't work out, what is it going to be? A sportscaster. And then I'll put that sportscasting on YouTube because we do a weekly kind of a sportscast video that we've done now for probably about 6 years. So check out Carson's YouTube channel. It's Carson Dad NFL Predictions. But and I go, okay, so if that doesn't work out, he's like, well, I'll probably end up doing investment real estate just to fund my dreams. And he goes, I'll just do some properties because that'll be pretty easy for me. Because I learned it from you. and then he's like, and then from that point, I'll go ahead and do the other things that I really want to do.
You know, I played around a little bit with broadcasting, and like I thought I would like being into like sports broadcasting, you know.
And but you do real estate broadcasting.
I know. Well, yeah, now it's funny how that all came full circle. But so the town I'm from has, you know, 1,200 people. And one of my good friends, his wife went to my high school, and her brother, who's probably about your age.
They married?
He is the voice of the Milwaukee Brewers.
Oh, that's so cool.
Suck it, Ted. So yeah, he hangs out with Bob Uecker all the time. Like that's a thing. His family moved to Milwaukee.
It's just generally a thing that small towns, everybody's related to. Those. So
I know that.
Yeah. I thought that's where you're going.
Okay,
it's kind of like Sarah Weaver being on a podcast, Uncle Owen.
Help! Anyway. Help!
I'm from a small town. He's right. We all are related.
We are related. See, it's not just Iowa.
Dayton High School.
Don't feed it.
Before we go to our segments, there's a question I do always love to ask, and is, have you had any crazy or weird investment stories in your investments that you currently have? Meaning, have you found something that's crazy or dead bodies? We love to hear, but anything that along those lines.
So kind of in that realm. So we're obviously, because we've used so much private money, I'm constantly talking about private money or real estate deals and looking for private money lenders. So as I just talked about, we have four kids and decided that four was plenty. Right. And so,
are you sure about that?
Yeah, no, I'm 100% sure about that. Okay. I'm 100% sure. Anyway, wouldn't want to not have a fourth, but I'm good. Anyway. So December last year, I went and got a vasectomy. And so in the procedure, like, you know, in the stirrups, I'll lay back and I was talking to the doctor. Turns out he has rental properties in Kansas or something, and decided he wanted to get out of them. Because he wanted something more passive. So I started pitching him on being a private money lender during the procedure, you know, and end up getting his card. And now he's one of our lenders that we use on a regular basis.
Shut up. He's actually a lender of yours. Yeah.
All right, the funny thing, Lauren, is I have a vasectomy story myself.
Well, do tell, Ted.
Okay, so
continue on with this shit show.
So when I got my vasectomy, I was actually the closing day for this building that we're in right now.
Wait, have a vasectomy?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I always told my wife, I go, I'm not having more kids past 40. And so at 40 happened, got a vasectomy. Anyway, so we're closing on this property right here. And I was like, I gotta go get the keys and do the walkthrough. And no kidding, I'm walking over here, and it is an ice storm that day. And freshly off the table, and I slip and fall.
Oh.
Of course, I wasn't feeling much at the time.
Oh, you were all numbed up still.
But yeah, but by the time I'm going through the walkthrough of all the units here, I am walking.
Dallas just called you numbnuts.
Numbnuts, yep. I'm walking like a gorilla. By the time I'm going through here, and Jessica calls me. She's like, "Why are you not home?" And I'm like, I had to walk this 5-unit real quick because I need to make sure everybody's out. And then there was tenants still living in here, and people weren't supposed to be here, and I was all stressed out and fighting with them. And then by the time I got home, Jessica's looking at me. She's like, "You are an idiot." And I get home, and I mean, I definitely probably made that recovery period an extra long time.
Because, oh my God. Okay,
let's. That's a good feeling for.
Yeah, right, that's there. Not a good visual for anyone. All right, what's next?
Failing forward.
And this failing forward is brought to you by JM Real Estate Capital.
Hi, it's Rob, JM Real Estate Capital. We're the money guys that you need to know for all your real estate investments. Talk to us. We can do what your local bank can't or won't do. We don't have millions. We have trillions with a T to lend. 844-WE-CLOSE or go online, jmrecapital.com. That's jmrecapital.com. JM Real Estate Capital, smart solutions for the real estate investor.
He's in the sauce. So, Lauren, what have you got for us that didn't go according to plan? It sounds like you have blown up in the last couple of years, but surely there's something that we can talk about that didn't go well.
Yeah, for sure. So when we got started, right, we, as everyone that's new, you then tend to underestimate how much renovations are going to cost. And as a business strategy, basically what we do is we purchase properties, rental properties, at least we did last year, all rental properties, and we collect the renovation money at closing after we close. And then we take that money and we fix the project. Well, what we started getting into doing, and this was a big screw up on our part, is we would get, we'd be $5,000 or $10,000 over budget on one, and then we'd use some money from the next one to finish that one. And this became this snowball where we were robbing from Peter to pay Paul. And it really came to a head in February of this year, where I took a really hard look at our books and put a full stop on everything we were doing. And basically, we had to sell a couple things and get ourselves out of the hole. But it came down to not having the right experience of underestimating things, having a few things go badly, like the sewage line that I talked about and a few HVACs. But it was humbling, because when you grow, when you're new investor, right, and you buy 29 properties and you're going to meetups and, oh, you're doing so great, and you get this big ego, and like all of a sudden it feels like you're unable to stop buying properties because that's what people expect you to do. Like, you've grown, like anything less than continued growth is going to be a hit to your ego. And I had to take a massive ego hit in February. Like, we screwed up, right? We need to put a stop. No one lost any money. We sold a couple properties. We started flipping to finish that out. So I had a good happy ending. We got ourselves out of that hole. But February and the beginning of March was rough from an ego standpoint. And then just like, we need to restructure this business and look at how we're running things to avoid these mistakes in the future and put some additional processes and systems in place to avoid that happening again.
Yeah, I love that. This year in particular has been so difficult to navigate with, because you don't know where the bottom is. You don't know. It's like, how do you catch a falling knife? And that changes a lot of things along the way, because you're not able to refinance as easily as you were before. Values maybe are a little bit squishy on what you can count on. And you have to pivot. But I think it takes, you got to eat humble pie once in a while. And I think what you went through in February was probably a great reset. And that's a real thing. What you're talking about is like when you're, I'm not saying you're ego driven, but I think, and it's natural for anybody to get some success early on and get some tailwinds behind you. And then all of a sudden you encounter some roadblocks and it's like, okay, we really have to take a hard look at this. And you can either ignore it or you can acknowledge it. And if you acknowledge it, then you have to make changes. Mm-hmm. And then, along the way is like, put on your big boy pants and admit that, wait a minute, we have to recapitalize, or we have to, like, we got out over our skis on a couple of deals and we have to make some hard decisions here and then just make smarter decisions moving forward. So good on you recognizing that. That could get out of control in a hurry.
Yeah. I went through that myself, because I sold a property that I had a ton of equity in, just to kind of reset, put some money back in an account. And there were some improvements I needed to do on the properties I did have to make sure that they were going to keep on being profitable. I had a parking lot I put in on, at one property and do some updates on another one. I had to fund a flip where the contractor went astray and I needed some money. So sometimes you just got to make a hard decision, suck it up, and just know that you're going to grow from it and that you're going to be better off in the end.
Well, I think they're, it's funny. I've talked about like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac before, where they typically like to operate where they have a lot of capital deployed into projects. And one of my friends was talking with a Fannie or Freddie like loan rep that they originate these type of loan products, and they said, how's your business, how's Fannie and Freddie doing, like, are they making a lot of loans that we don't know about? And they said, and I quote, "We are working on operational excellence," is how they put it, which reading between the lines there means they're not doing shit for loans. They're just like taking a breath, reassessing, balancing their books. And I think that's a good lesson for a lot of people is like when you get into uncertain times, it's not necessarily a bad time to take chips off the table, reassess, figure out where you need to, like what moves you're going to make to grow instead of just putting your head down and growing like crazy and blindly growing. You know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah, good on you for reassessing. I mean, that's it's hard to do, but it helps everybody.
Yeah. It's never good to bury your head in the sand because it just makes it exacerbates the problem. And when you finally do, when it does come to a head, it's beyond a point where you can do anything to fix it. Right. We caught it early enough that we could do some things, not only in the moment to fix them, but also fix things in the future so they didn't happen again. You know, one of the reasons why that happened the way it did is we had bought a bunch of properties in like August to October, and they were all rental properties. So we spent a ton of time in October, November, and December renovating properties for rent. Well, guess what? Nobody wants to rent or move in January or February. And so we had 40% vacancy in January and February, and like three applications came in because everybody spent all their money at Christmas. And so now we've shifted strategies where like to 2 days is October 1st. We're done buying rentals until December for the rest of the year. And we'll basically take October and we'll maybe buy some really good deals as they pop up from a flipping standpoint, but we're not buying flips really until December to prime the pump for this beginning of the selling, you know, the prime season in March. And so shifting when we buy instead of just what we buy is impacting our overall strategy as well.
No, that's a good point. And it highlights also the different geographic challenges that people have with winter time and like the velocity of home buyers in certain markets versus others. So I think it seems to me that, you know, September through say January is generally the really is Ted, you would probably know this better than me, but that's generally the slowest time.
I would say August for sure. But if you're working with investors, it's August through November because generally August is terrible because their kids are going back to school. So that's the start of the month and summer's in. So vacations are done and people just aren't buying in August. I personally, for my real estate business, August is the worst. And then I do mainly investment clients. So December is actually generally one of my best months of the year because a lot of people want to get properties buy properties before their taxes are due.
Yeah, interesting.
So generally, December is amazing.
Well, Lauren, we've kept you here for 2 hours, as is our thing. And we have one final section that we want to put you through the gauntlet on.
We're almost out of time. Let's get into the OT with Owen and Ted.
So we've got some questions here for you, if you're ready for them, we ask every guest, and we want to hear what you have. Question one, what is going to be the title or subject of your first book?
So I thought about this. I knew this was coming. I thought about this. And so it's going to be Gregarious, How to Succeed with Marginal Intelligence. And it'll be all about how you can basically grow your network to the point where it has outpaced your knowledge base, but you still can be very successful. And it comes from
I have a guy that can write the foreword for you on that. It's Colin Schwartz. So go ahead. Please continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yeah.
So I had a professor when I was in grad school, and we were driving to a meeting one time. And so when you're in grad school, everything's about writing papers, right? If you don't publish, you perish. And he was telling me, he's like, you need to be like extremely, it's all the influence friends or win friends and influence people concept, right? You need to be friendly, you need to be positive, and you want to have people want to be around you because he's like, I've been tenured for 10 years. You know how many papers I've written in the 20 years I've been in the department? I'm like, no, how many? He's like, one, right? He's wrote one paper and he got tenured because people wanted to be around him. He provided value beyond the just writing papers. And there's other people that were writing papers constantly. Nobody wanted them around and they did not get tenure. And that really stuck with me when I was a 20-year-old.
Love it, man.
So we're on a podcast and it's called Lauren Knows Real Estate. And Lauren can interview anybody in the world today. Who is Lauren going to interview? And what question are you dying to ask them?
I really struggled with this question because everybody that I know is like already on a billion podcast. And I don't do a whole lot of like fanboying for anybody besides for Owen. So
thanks, man.
But be a little cliche, but I'm a huge Alex Hormozi fan. And so I know he doesn't do real estate, but I think of myself less of a real estate investor as I get moving forward and more of a business owner operator. And real estate is the vehicle that I do that in. And so I would want to sit down with Alex, and as brilliant as he is, I would want to talk to him more about where he sees the power of branding in specifically real estate, in the next 20 years, because I want to see if it lines up to what, where I think it is. I think that what Brandon Turner and what some of the other big names that are in real estate have done. I saw an advertisement for one of Brandon Turner's deals yesterday, and it wasn't even from Brandon. It was like from Open Door, but it was like, it was using his name, like Brandon Turner's deal or something, like in the advertisement. And it just shows the power of branding. You get yourself to a certain point, and there's so much trust behind that brand that you don't even have to be in it. You just have to use your name, and people already are like, okay, I'll give you your money. I'll give you money.
Well, it goes back to your whole, comment about your reputation. Like it all comes back to that. So personal branding is basically the end result of a springboard of personal branding. So you have to develop trustworthiness and reputation in order to get any leverage on your personal brand. So I think that's great forward thinking from you, and looking at people that have used it to their advantage is like one of the smartest things you can do. Next question for you. We are at your funeral. Very sad. Your four kids are there and your wife, maybe kid number five. We don't know. The vasectomy, it's TBD on whether that worked or not.
I'm thinking of a finger.
Who is delivering your eulogy, and what do you hope they'll say about you?
Yeah. So obviously I would want this, again, cliche, but I'd want my kids to have very positive things to say about me. So I'd want them there. But in general, I hope that the impact that I have on anybody that I come in contact with is profound enough that it's a very full room, and that I spend a little bit of time like mentoring people that are under me. I believe that I should always have a mentor that's above me, and I should always be helping people come up that are below me. And so I'm hoping that as I continue through this, that there are a number of people that I've mentored and brought up that would be there and be willing to say something kind about me. But at the end of the day, I'll be dead, so it won't really matter who says what. But that's what I would hope. So,
well, speaking of mentors and profound impact, what mentor in your life has had the most profound impact on you?
So there's a couple, and it just depends on the stage of my life. So when I was a crop consultant, the owner of the company was a huge mentor for me, really showed me the value of hard work and kind of thinking outside the box. The guy that mentored me in my first property was very influential. And then as you know, we've kind of grown and our business strategies have changed and you know, diverted, you know, a little less so. Not that there's anything wrong with him, just you know, we think about things differently. I think I get a lot of my mentorship now from people that I haven't specifically met in person, but through podcast and through calls, you know, books and things, because I'm looking to people that have done things that are outside of what I'm used to doing. I have a business coach that doesn't even do real estate. He was in like the SaaS environment or SaaS industry. And I specifically picked him because it wasn't real estate, because I wanted a different viewpoint than like the normal real estate, like go into syndication, do this. I wanted a different perspective on business. And so that's why I chose him.
Awesome. What are you looking for in your business right now? Do you have any like holes in your like hiring platform? Are you looking for people, money, deals? Like what's that look like for Lauren and crew?
So always looking for money, always looking for deals. We're specifically looking in Eastern North Carolina right now, basically east of Raleigh. And then money, I'm always looking for additional lenders to talk to about opportunities. I have my team built out for now, but we'll be looking to add transaction coordinators, closers, So if anybody's a really good salesperson and wants to get in on our wholesaling business, we'll be looking for closers. That's going to be a virtual position probably in the next 6 to 9 weeks. And then from a transactional lending standpoint, I am looking hard for more wholesalers that are doing deals, that are doing double closes and want to work with a really good transactional lender.
Yeah, Lauren, I just want to shout out you, man. The content that you provide today and the story that you have is amazing. And the fact that you actually were brought in by Owen is the most shocking part. But but thank you so much for coming in today. Thank you for telling your story. I think that when people listen to this, they're going to think about how fast that you have grown, but they're also going to think that about you being a family man and that you're balancing this many units, this many kids, and also that you have a full-time job going on at the same time. And you're going to, I mean, we respect you, and I can't imagine respect to the people listening to you right now. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for everything you're doing. And it's too bad you're not going to be at BPCon, because you're going to be missing that good time. This recording is going to come way after BPCon, but it's a shame that we won't see you out there and meet you in person. But if you do make it to Nebraska, we love to get together and have an old fashioned with you, so that in that way you're not just watching us drink.
I mean, the last time I was in Nebraska, I was in North Platte, so I would love to come to Nebraska sometime. See you guys.
And if you're loving what you're hearing right now, we really appreciate you giving us a review on whatever format they listen to. And if it's on Apple, please give us a written review. Throw out some questions, and I'm sure Lauren will eventually see them, or we'll pass them on to them. Give us some feedback on this podcast and any other podcast that you loved. But we appreciate you guys listening. And with that, Owen Dashner, we see us out.
On behalf of Dentalist Bertrand, Rhea Radio, and Ted Kosh, I'm Owen Dashner, and you've been listening to Lauren, the entomologist, brewmaster, wholesaler, flipper, and double closer, Hornet. Signing off. He's actually a lender of yours?
Yeah.
Something got pitched, that's for sure. You radio edited that out.
I'm sorry on behalf of Rhea Radio for Ted.